Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome everybody. Good evening. And discuss Pesach tonight instead. From the coursework, they have a class on Pesach, which I have borrowed liberally from, and we will discuss some of those important concepts tonight. Do that. Okay, let's get started. Let me start with two questions. Two questions on Pesach. They are questions which you probably are familiar with on some level. But if not, they're a good spring. A good springboard to begin our discussion this evening. Am I too loud? Okay, great. Question number one is as follows: Have any idea? How many guesses? How many mitzvos would you say? How many various different commandments, prohibitions, positive things to do? Do we have affiliated with the Pesach story? Like, how many different mitzvahs are there that we would say on it, Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim? This mitzvah is because some way, somehow, tied in to Pesach. Would you guess? I'll give you, would you guess like 1, 10, 20, 30, 40? Where would you put the number on a mitzvah that if we traced it back, we would say this has something to do with the Pesach story? What would be some of your guesses? 36? Good.
150.
So I believe it's less than 150, but it's more than 20. It's more than 20. I didn't actually count them up. But it is in the 20, 30 to 40 range in which you can say this mitzvah is because of Pesach. If we get down to it and you think about all of the laws of actual, the yontiv of Pesach, then that really, the numbers of laws just jumps off the tables, off the charts, just in terms of the prohibition of chametz and how to prepare the Karban Pesach. But even how one eats the Karban Pesach, we don't have an actual Karban Pesach today. If you guys, by the way, think that Erev Pesach is crazy busy, this, like for us, do you know what it's really supposed to be like? In the real deal, when the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and the way that it used to be when the Beis HaMikdash stood, on Erev Pesach, you had a very important job to do. And that was go to the Beis HaMikdash, starting around noon. And from noon on, you would be busy with the bringing of your Karban Pesach, the preparing of your Karban Pesach, the roasting of your Karban Pesach, so that you have it ready to eat that night when Yontif starts at your Seder. You can't go to the store from the time that the Karban Pesach could be brought, which is about, you know, noonish, chatzos, in Atlanta time, it would be around like 1:30 in the afternoon. It was Yontif already. You couldn't do certain malachas because you were supposed to be focused already on the Karban Pesach. Which means, again, if you think it's busy now, you were already into Pesach mode on Erev Pesach. It was already a chag because you would bring your Karban Pesach and then you'd spend the afternoon getting it ready, roasting it, because come the Seder, that's going to be what you're going to be eating at your Seder. There are many, many halachas regarding the bringing of the Korban Pesach and how you eat it. The fact that it has to be roasted whole, it can't be cooked, you can't break a bone, you can't take it outside, you can't have any leftovers. All of these are counted amongst the 613, just the six or seven things I just rattled off right now. All of those are listed as separate commandments in relation to our 613 just about the Korban Pesach, plus all the prohibitions of chametz, then eating matzah, and then all the other mitzvahs which are affiliated. Easily 20, 30 mitzvahs which would fit into the Pesach. How many about Sukkot would you say? Well, you have don't eat outside of a sukkah, or dwell in a sukkah, probably positive or negative, and probably that's about it. Two, maybe if you want to count the lulav and esrog, you get three. Nothing compares to what you get with Pesach. Why? Question number one. Why so many? I'm not saying not to have some. Of course we should have some. But so many. So many times. The phrase, Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim, it's a familiar phrase, right? You know why it's so familiar? Because we say it all the time. Zecher li Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's in all the Shemona Esrei's of Yontiv. We say it in Kiddush Friday night every week. Zecher li Yetzias Mitzrayim. All the time. Why so many? Question number one. Question number two, which is another question which I'm sure has bothered many of you. What are we celebrating Pesach time? Freedom. Freedom. We say it in the tefillah, in our davening. Zman Cheroseinu. It's a time of our freedom. We left the servitude, we left bondage. We begin the whole Seder night feeling like we are slaves, and we leave as free people. So we are celebrating the freedom. Here's the question. I'll say it bluntly. I'm sure you've all either been bothered by or heard some form of this question before. Who put us into slavery? With our Jewish eyeglasses. God put us into slavery. It was stated in the Torah before we ever got down to Egypt that that's going to happen to us. So God puts us into slavery. And then what does He do? Then He takes us out. And then we celebrate that He made us free. So He put us in, He took us out, and then we celebrate that He made us free. So how does that work? That we were put into slavery by Hashem. He then takes us out of slavery, and then we make a yontiv about it. But not just a yontiv, you have to clean your whole house kind of yontiv. So it's not just say like, this is an easy kind of yontiv. This is going to be like a hard kind of yontiv to celebrate the freedom from the servitude that He put us into. Those are the two springboard questions that we will start with for tonight. Let's learn a little bit. No guarantees of any answers. Questions I like asking. Answers are much harder to come by. But I hope that some of the sources that we will study together, if not fully answering these questions, will begin the dialogue, begin the discussion. And if nothing else, will put us in the Pesach mode as we begin to move very quickly and irreversibly towards Pesach next Friday night, Mirtz Hashem. So let's begin with let's learn a little bit together. Next Friday night, yeah. That's next Friday night. This is Friday night. That's next Friday night.
They work for the State Department.
What is that? No, right? This Friday night is 4 days from now. Next Friday night, yeah. You can't stop it. It's coming. Well, you know, whatever you want to call it, it's coming. It's less than 2 weeks. However you want to speak about that, that's fine with me. Okay, let's start with the Gemara. The Gemara in Maseches Nedarim on page, it's on the bottom of your first sheet, but it's page number 5. Our page numbers are going to bounce around a little bit. The Gemara Nedarim, it's in the middle of the first box, asks the following question, in the name of Rabbi Avohu, in the name of Rabbi Eliezer. Mipnei ma ne'enosh Avraham Avinu, why was Avraham punished by having his descendants enslaved for 210 years in Egypt? The Gemara asks this question straight out. Why? What happened that we needed such servitude, so long, so hard, so difficult? What did he do wrong? The Gemara gives a number of answers. One of the answers, one of the opinions that the Gemara quotes in the name of Shmuel is very relevant to us in our discussion for tonight. Shmuel says as follows, Shehifriz al midosav, because Avraham doubted God's credibility in fulfilling His promise. Where do we see God doubting God's credibility in fulfilling His promise? So the Gemara records the story in which Hashem takes Avraham and says to him, I am the God who took you out of Ur Kasdim, and I'm going to make you into a great nation, and I'm going to make your children as numerous as the stars above and on the sand below. And Hashem and Avraham responds to the promise that Hashem gives him and says, Bama Eida ki Iroshenev, with what will I know that I will indeed inherit the land? I misspoke for a second. Let me go back 1 second. Hashem makes to Avram two promises. One is about children, and the other one is about the land. Promises the land of Eretz Canaan, the land that Avram is in. I'm going to give you this land to you and to your descendants afterwards. To that second promise, the promise of the land, Avram asks, how do I know? How do I know? What's my guarantee that this will happen? Hashem takes him out and shows him the stars. There's a whole story which takes place over there. But Avram asks that question. How will I know that I will indeed inherit this land? And the Gemara records in the name of Shmuel, that's it. That sent us, his descendants, into Mitzrayim for 210 years because of that slight lack of belief in the credibility of God to fulfill His promise. The Maral, source number 2 on the page, explains, God placed Avram's descendants in exile because he was lacking in his belief and trust in Him. God therefore placed his descendants in exile in order that they would correct this mistake and fully trust in Him. They would also see the power of God's deeds for those whom He loves, as well as the awesome power He showed to the Egyptians through the plagues. Have here a very powerful statement. Very powerful statement that Avram is the seed that from which the entire tree, the bark, expands out, and all the branches upon which we hang of the Jewish people come. And that has to be strong and it has to be perfect. And when there is a flaw or a blemish, even a slight one, but if there's a slight blemish in the root, in the source of everything, then that needs to be corrected. We, the Jewish people who are going to stem from that, have to have those small little blemishes, so to speak, corrected. And we find this often from the Avos, from Avraham, from Yitzhak and Yaakov, that which are our pillars, our roots, the slightest mistakes that they make become very much expanded. I've given this example many times in different contexts, but it's basically the same kind of example in which you have two people who work for a hospital. Two people, one person's job is to collect the fee, the parking tickets, and one person's job is to be a neurosurgeon. They both work for the hospital. What's the difference between these two employees of the hospital? Just a few differences. One is, well, let's say they both mess up. Let's say someone comes to the parking, comes with his ticket, and the person who's supposed to be paid to collect the ticket and take his $4 is playing with his phone and is totally not paying attention to the fact that somebody drives right by, and look at that, car just went right by, didn't pay his $4. Can you imagine? What's the cost of this error? $4. Now, it's a pretty egregious error considering what his job is, but the cost in the big picture to the hospital won't show up anywhere. Neurosurgeon is the middle of surgery and his phone rings. Right? And he takes his eye off what he's doing for a split second. And like 2 millicentimeters, like nothing, makes a wrong. You know, what's the cost of that error? You know, it could be indescribable. It could be indescribable as far as the patient's health, lawsuits afterwards. Assuming even the patient, like after the 6 hours that it takes you to correct the error, say nothing. He moved his hand a centimeter. I know. You're a neurosurgeon. When you're a neurosurgeon, it's a different job than collecting the parking tickets. Who gets paid more? Right? Why? Because they're commensurate with each other. Your responsibility, the impact you can have, the life-saving impact versus simply just, you know, you're taking a job. That's how it works. So Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov are the source of everything that we have. So an error that they make, even though to the rest of us, wouldn't even rate as an error. It doesn't even begin to enter the page of having done something wrong. But at the source, it's so significant what's happening. Their roles are so significant. The slightest errors have massive ramifications. And in the same way as a neurosurgeon who might slightly move his hand 2 centimeters off from where it should be, it might take 6 hours of surgery to rectify that. And this happens in surgery all the time. Not all the time. Where a person makes a mistake, they cut a vein, an artery that they shouldn't, and now you got to spend 6 hours sewing it up, cleaning it up. Why does it spend? These 6 hours are a result of a small infraction. That's what it takes when you're dealing with something so sensitive, so significant. A slight error requires a tremendous amount of time and energy to fix. When you're talking about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the slightest error requires a lot of energy to fix. Says the Gemara, Avraham had a slight error in emunah, in his belief. To us, his belief was way off the charts for us. But for him at the source, slight. And it cost his children 210 years in Mitzrayim to fix. Now with this as a springboard, I'll take, I see two questions right away. Well, we're going to leave, let me just say one more sentence and I'll take your questions. I hope and it will. Therefore, something about these next 210 years are going to have to net the result that that problem is fixed. If that's how the Gemara sees it, then when we come out of the 210 years, what brought us in there somehow has to be remedied, has to be rectified. And that's when we say at our Haggadah, as we sit around our Seder tables, and we say, B'chol dor vador, every generation, Chayev Adam liros etz atzmu, every person has to see himself. How does that conclude? Anybody remember? Ke'ilu hu yotza mi Mitzrayim, as if he himself left Egypt. When the Jews left Egypt, they've remedied the problem that put them in there in the first place, and we have to get through a Seder and then come out of that Seder in that same place, having fixed that problem of that Emunah issue that Avraham had.
Well, the doctor had to pay for his mistake right then and there, for his whole life. You're not saying his children...
100%. Welcome to the Jewish people.
Why?
Welcome to the Jewish people. 100%. You're right. You're saying a very good point. That's, we are a people. 100%. We are a family, we are a people, generations upon generations, building, moving towards world perfection, each step along the way. Along that. We are, I want to say like unique, but we certainly have that quality of a people. That touches on one of the things that we've spoken about so many times, of free will, we've spoken about suffering, we've spoken about not understanding what's going on in world history, and part of that is something that happens in the 1700s leads to the Jewish people developing, forming, shaping, moving forward, and we have that. I've quoted, I'm sure, many times also, Rav Shamshon Fol Hirsch has a language in which he says, Hatzibur lo meis, a congregation never dies. Individuals live their life, they're born, they live, they die. Happens to each and every one of us. The right time, Yirtzeh Hashem, after 120 years. So none of us, nor any one of our predecessors, will be here, like forever. Eventually we'll be resurrected, but that's a separate class. But the tzibur, the congregation, the people, is an organism. He doesn't use this example, but I'm sure I've said that. I feel like I've been here so many years already, like everything that I have to say, I've said already at some point or another. I feel like I'm repeating myself. We talk about the human body. So every cell that's in our human, in our bodies right now, how old is that cell? How old is the cell? It's not that old. I think the number 3 years, maybe. I think it's not a long time. But how old is the organism? However old you are, you don't have to tell me, I'm not, whatever. 23, I know. So, right? So what happens is our body is constantly regenerating all the cells of our body. So that each cell is not as old as we are, because cells, individual cells within our body die and they're regenerated, and they're, but we don't measure the organism by the individual cell, we measure the organism lives on. Even though every part of our organism was not here when we were born. I don't think there's a single cell in our bodies now that was there when we were born. They've all, the cells die, they're new cells that take their place, but the organism lives on. And so therefore, no human being can say, I can't be held responsible for something I did 5 years ago, it wasn't me. Right? And then they'll scientifically show you that every part of them wasn't involved in whatever it was that they did 5 years ago. I mean, that's a joke. That doesn't work. So that's the Jewish people. That's like the model that we have as a people. And even though it could be our ancestors which did one thing or another, but we continue on. Okay, yeah. Okay, this is before he got to that stage of his life. Yeah, this is before. This is well before he has any children. He gets this promise. He's just gotten to the land of Canaan. And he's not going to have a child for almost 25 years, even after he's promised children and promised the land. That's all part of his own growth and development, so to speak. It's like even, I can't even say that about an Avraham Avinu, but yes, there's his... Okay. Let's move on. The bottom of page 5, again, that first page. So at the end of Sefer Dvarim, Moshe uses the following language. He says, Hashem has taken you out, Mikor HaBarzel MiMitzrayim, from the iron crucible which was Egypt. And Rashi explains that this idea of why the Torah itself refers to Egypt, refers to Mitzrayim, as this iron crucible, is because Rashi says that's the vessel where you purify gold. And in the same way that the true purpose behind Egypt, I'm on the top of page 6 now, the true purpose behind the Egyptian slavery was to purify the Jewish people of their baser characteristics, just as gold is purified in a crucible. And therefore Hashem wanted to remove the base metal so that only the pure gold would remain. And to this end, many of those Jews who were unworthy died in the plague of darkness, and only those who remained were chosen to receive the Torah. So you have here a quote from the Ksav HaKabbalah, one of our commentators, who actually point, like, the Torah refers to Mitzrayim as the Kur HaBarzel, an iron crucible, because you purify gold there. And when you purify gold, well, how does that work? You have to remove the impurities. That's how the process works. And when you remove impurities, first of all, it takes a lot of heat. It's a hard process. It's a difficult process. Things get left behind as you extract it. But what you're left with is pure. And in the start of our nation, we went through that process. And there was a difficult slavery, which is like the iron furnace, which is going to purify us. It's going to separate the impurities, both within the individual Jew's character development. And, as our sages say, there were actually Jews who are left behind as well. There are Jews who said, we don't want to go. We don't want it. And as the sages say in the plague of darkness, up to 4/5 of the Jewish people perish in the plague of darkness. Not because God looked at them and said, you're not worthy, because they looked at God and said, we're not interested. We don't want to go. We like it here in Egypt. And they're left behind. So what you're left with is a people who are ready to go. So frightening, that medrash, that statement of the sages is always frightening. As we move in as we hurtle through the Gaulus, through the exile, with the finish line in sight, only 6,000 miles away, and half the Jewish population is living there, will we relive the Pesach experience of choosing to go, of 4/5 of the Jewish people being lost? And the numbers, when you read the Pew Report and you read the numbers of assimilation, and you see as we inch closer to 80%, it used to be 50, now they're talking 55, 60. There's a certain point where we're almost back to where we were in Egypt, where 80% of the Jews stayed behind and were lost in exile, and only those who were purified, who wanted it, actually left. Okay, just a thought to consider. Let us move forward. Take a look at page 7, source number 7. This is from Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who I've quoted several times, wrote the Michtam Eliyahu. Rav Dessler was a contemporary Rav who passed away about 50, 60 years ago. So he writes as follows: every time that there is a need to give a righteous person the possibility of rising to a very high level, he is thrown into the worst environment so that he should learn that evil is futile and thus strive to reach the highest limit. So he starts with this an idea of when it's time to take a righteous person and bump him up to a higher level, so you don't put him in a cushy environment. How do you bring out a person's strengths? We've spoken about this again also many times. A person's strengths are almost always brought out from difficulty, when a person has to really reach deep down within themselves to see what it is that they need. Similarly, he writes, when Israel and the Jewish people needed to prepare to accept the Torah, God did not send them to the heavenly yeshiva from where Moshe took the Torah. Beautiful poetic language. Where does Moshe go to get the Torah? So Moshe goes to yeshiva. Where's his yeshiva? On Har Sinai. He doesn't need to eat. He doesn't need to sleep. If you can imagine a Gan Eden, a yeshiva, he's got a chavrusa with God. No distractions. No need to eat or sleep. It's perfect. Why didn't he do that for the Jewish people? How come we didn't get a heavenly yeshiva? We got Egypt instead. So that's right. That's right. Your emissary who's going to bring you the Torah, he gets the heavenly yeshiva. But the people, to get themselves ready, And you want to be ready to receive that, you get Egypt. He sent them instead, the opposite, into the bondage in Egypt, to be slaves to people who had sunk to the 49th level of impurity. And the slavery brought them to a state where they cried out to Hashem to return to them. And this return, this teshuva, which began in the polar extreme of physical enslavement and frustration, was the cause of their astonishing ascent to the spiritual level of receiving the Torah, which is compared to the 49th level of spiritual purity. So here we have a second idea. We have, on the one hand, there was a slight infraction from Avraham, from our first of our fathers, a slight infraction in the level of Emunah, of the belief system that he had. And how do we correct that? So through the trials and tribulations of slavery, his descendants, through the difficulties, will be purified in the iron furnace that is Egypt, in order to get to the place that they need to get to. Okay, let's move on. Flip to page 10. Again, I'm not the 10th page in your packet, just on the using the bottom of your numbers. You'll see in the bottom half of the page, source number 1 of Maharal. So where do we see this? So let's introduce this section with, so if the purpose is for us to become purified, to achieve a new level of understanding, so somehow the plagues or the exodus must do that. And what else says as follows? Each plague would increase in severity such that a harsh plague would not be followed by a lighter one, but by a more harsh one. Therefore, the plagues ascended in severity from lowest to highest. So we have the Maharal expresses each one was more difficult for the Egyptians, expressed more about the existence of God. What I want to share with you now is a beautiful series of sources from the Malbim. The Malbim was, I believe, was in the 1800s, a commentator on Chumash. And he breaks down, he's really basing himself on an idea from the Ramban, Nachmanides, who lived much earlier in the 1200s, that the plagues can be broken down, the 10 plagues, into three sets of three. First three, second three, third three, they came in patterns. The first two were given with a warning, and then the third one came without a warning. Meaning Moshe went to Paro before the first one and said, if you don't let them go, I'm going to bring this plague. And then it happened. Then the second plague, he gave him a warning again. But then the third one just came without any warning to Paro. Then there was a second set of three, which the same four and five was given a warning and six not. And each one of the three sets had a specific agenda as to what it was supposed to teach us through them. We'll go through them quickly, and you have a beautiful chart on the bottom of page 12, which you could flip back and forth to as we go through these as well. Take them to your Seder. It's a very nice thing to share with everybody who'll be sitting with you at your Seder. It says as follows. I'm going to go back to the bottom of page 10 to the first of the three plagues. The first of the three plagues demonstrated the existence of God. What was the goal of the first three? Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, blood, frogs, lice, was in response to Paro saying, who is this God that I should listen to him? God, Paro denies the existence. So the first three plagues were specifically there to establish the existence. And you see that on the top of page 11, the first box on the top of the page. The first set of three plagues, blood, frogs, and lice, was to demonstrate the reality and existence of God, which is alluded to in the verse, Leman teida ki ani Hashem, that you should know that I am God. And this was due to the fact that Paro denied God's existence when he said, who is God that I should listen to his voice? If you'll now flip to page 12, if you'll see that at the top of your chart, the blood, frogs, lice part of your... Is this too confusing? Am I back and forth too much? Just to keep you awake. The blood, frogs, lice part of the chart. So you see the physical location. Where did these three plagues come from? The first set of plagues came from below, from the water, from the earth, from being a lesser form of plague, and they were performed by Aharon. What do they show God's power over moving in the chart? Water, aquatic creatures, and dust of the earth. Then you get to the next plague, and if you want to follow it inside, flip back to page 11. Second set of plagues demonstrate God's providence and control of the world's details, says the Malbim in the middle of that second box on the page. The second set of three plagues, wild animals, epidemic, and boils, demonstrated God's providence. Because Paro did not believe that the Supreme God supervises each person and event individually in the midst of the land, Bekerev Haaretz. And this demonstration of God's providence is alluded to in the verse, so that you shall know that I am God in the midst of the land. In plain English, first three establish there is God, I am here. The second three are, and I am aware and control everything that happens. In the words of the Ramban, which we've also quoted prior in other classes, there are three types of people in the world. There are those who deny the existence of God. Then there are those who say there is a God, but he has no idea what's going on over here. Philosophically they refer to that as the fishbowl. He watches, but he doesn't do anything. He's no control over that which is taking place. So the second set of three plagues were specifically in response to that. And if you look at your chart on the bottom of page 12 again, you see the second set of plagues. Where did they come from? They came from above the ground and from the air. Being a higher form of plague, they were performed by Moshe himself, not by Aaron. And they showed God's power over land animals, life of the land animals, and over humans. And then just moving quickly into the next page, bottom, going back to page 11 again, the third set of plagues demonstrate that God's power is absolute and unparalleled. In response to powers, claim that even if God has powers, other gods have equal powers. And so here you see in the third set of plagues, Moshe was being instructed to tell Paro that the purpose of the third set, hail, locust, and darkness, was to demonstrate that God had absolute and unparalleled power. Even though God's existence and providence were already demonstrated, Paro still thought that there existed other gods and powers who might sometimes overpower God. And therefore, these three say there is nothing else and no one else who can possibly compare to him. So, doing this quickly, but this is what we're supposed to experience as we go through the Seder, as we go through the plagues. It was, see that I am here, see that I control anything that I want, and see that there is no one else, nothing else, no other power that can possibly keep up with anything in that as well. That's the goal. We start with an Avram who was a slight infraction. The purpose is for us to be able to remedy, rectify that. I want to share with you a comment that's on the bottom of page 17, which we will throw in over here. This is from Rabbi Akiva Tatz, who is a contemporary Rav, who is living now in London teaching. And he writes as follows. He asks a very beautiful question. He's really quoting from the Sfas Emes. Sfas Emes was the third Ger Rebbe. He lived in the 1700s, I believe, but I might be wrong, maybe the 1800s, a little bit more recent. Sfas Emes writes, what do we call we refer to the night of the Pesach, we refer to the Seder night. What does Seder actually mean? Order. And I'm sure many of you have heard this question before. If there was any night on the Jewish calendar that has no order, meaning that is out of order, that is out of the ordinary, that is the least normal, it's the Seder night. So why do we call it the Seder nights? We call it the night of order, when everything is done specifically in an out of order way. And we say, what's the answer to every question the kids ask? Why do we do this? In order that the kids will ask, which means the whole night is specifically set up in an out of order kind of way, so that the children will ask, "Hey, why are you doing that?" And we call it the night of order. Says the Sfas Emes, the bottom of page 17. Sfas Emes expresses the connection between miracles commemorated at the Seder and the rest of Jewish history in the most beautiful manner. He asks why we call the procedure of Seder night a Seder when it means order, a regular, predictable series of events. Strange that we celebrate the most potent series of miracles, the sharpest departures from the natural order, with the name Seder. Not only is our night out of order, but what we're commemorating and celebrating is God changing the natural order of everything that we know. All of the 10 plagues that we recognize and that we work our evening through, the first three to prove that God exists, the second three that He controls, the third three that no one has any power like Him, they were all a change of the natural order. That's what we're playing up, so to speak. That's what we're highlighting, and we call it order. Says the Sfas Emes in Rabbi Akiva Tatz's beautiful language in which he's quoting the Sfas Emes. His answer is unforgettable. For the Jewish people, our natural order is the miraculous. That is our natural order. We have a Seder of miracles. We have, for us, this is our order. We were forged in impossible circumstances, conceived in a blaze of miracles, born beyond time. We can never descend into the natural. For us to do so would be souring of the worst kind, transforming matzah to chametz, lethal in the extreme, which he's referencing a whole other concept, which we're not going to get into too much tonight. But in his poetic language, we function in the miraculous. And therefore, our whole night of Pesach celebrating miracles is because That's all that we have. I think one of the Israeli prime ministers said it best, was it Netanyahu? He said, in Israel, to be a realist, you have to believe in miracles. I mean, there's no other way to survive over here. That's the only way to be a realist, is to believe in miracles. And that's the Jewish people. And we see that in the world doesn't want us to behave in normal... They want us to behave in normal ways, and we never have, and we just don't. And that's our Seder. Our Seder is functioning in the realm of the miraculous, and that is what the entire Seder is specifically about. Using Rabbi Akiva Tatz's beautiful poetic language, we were forged in impossible circumstances from an Avraham and a Sarah who could not have children, and we were conceived in a blaze of miracles through the exodus of Mitzrayim and born beyond time. I want to just quickly mention, moving forward onto your next set of pages, goes back in pages, back to pages 2 and 3, the idea that what we're experiencing is literally a birth. As we are experiencing the Exodus, many of our sources literally put it in the form, as you see in the top of the middle of page 3, that our exile in Egypt was a fetus in the womb, our Exodus from Egypt is birth, and then from Exodus until receiving the Torah is growth and maturation. So that we're literally, as we experience this Pesach Seder, going through the process of, while we're in Egypt, is like developing in the womb. And that's described, if you look on source number 3, on page number 3, that exile in Egypt is compared to the gestation of a fetus in the womb. A fetus develops internally, hidden from outside view. So too, God formed the Jewish people and prepared their redemption while He remained hidden from view. So while we are slaves in Egypt, we're forming as a people. God is still hidden from the picture. We don't see Him. Furthermore, the Jews did not perceive that they were becoming God's nation. It appeared to them as if there was no justice and no judge, and that evil was prevailing. However, if one looked beneath the surface, one could see that God's providence was at work. This is a beautiful little quote from Chaim Freelander, also a contemporary rabbi, which I find beautiful in our contemporary times. The Jews in Egypt, if you were to have stopped a Jew in the street who was in the middle of his slavery in year 206 of the 210 years, and would say, do you know that you're being formed as a nation right now? What would he say? Right? He'd say, go away. I have like bricks to make. We know that because when Moshe actually came and told them, we're leaving, they said to him, go away. I have bricks to make. But if you were to ask the Jews in those last couple of years even, do you recognize what's happening? They would have said, no. It's development in the womb. It's before there's a consciousness of the child. It can't be seen by those on the outside. We know already in our stage of medical development, we know exactly what's going on. But it's happening inside. But a child is being formed. Child doesn't know what's happening, and it's happening almost to him as it's growing and developing, but it's happening. And that's the birth of the Jewish people is in Mitzrayim. They as a nation are unaware of what's happening, just trying to survive. But meanwhile, in the iron furnace of Mitzrayim, the people are being formed. And I just get that sense as we're like going through history now, it's like the Jewish people are being recreated, so to speak, out of the exile. And that's sort of happening in its own little sense. But that's certainly what happened in Egypt. And then what happens? Then there's a birth. And what does a birth correspond to? That's the actual Exodus, which happens b'chipazon. It happens with great haste. Now, I don't want to offend any of the courageous women in the room. I don't want to say it happens very quickly. I know that many labors are not so quick. But in relation to the 9 months of pregnancy, it's pretty quick. And the Exodus from Egypt, which happens b'chipazon, it's with great haste, and then the nation is born. They're a slave nation, and then the next morning, literally like they wake up in the morning, and they're a free people, and they're a nation. Well, now you just have this little baby. Well, what does a baby need to do? Well, that baby now needs to grow and mature and develop and make its mistakes and learn to walk and learn to get along with others and all the things that go on as a child develops. That's no longer happening to the child. That's now the child, that's us, maturing. We are active participants in that. We have to learn from our mistakes. We have to grow. We have to develop. We have to live and experience and become greater people. That's the experience post-Exodus. Really, forever, we're just continuing that process, but in our short-term equation until we get to the land of Israel, our 40 years in the desert, and all the mistakes that we make, and all the errors, and all the complaints, and all the things that we read through in the Chumash as we read through those 40 years in the desert, that's now, it's not happening to the people like what happened in Egypt, that's the gestation period, it's not the birth, now you're here, now you exist. Grow, mature, develop. And as all of you know, that never ends. As long as we have breath in our nostrils and we are alive in this world, there's more growth to be done, there's more development, there's more, I don't want to use the maturity, but we become better people. And that's a constant process that we never hit a point where we say like, oh, I'm good. Never. It's always grow more, develop more. Yeah. Oh, excellent. Very good. How come no one else asked that question? You're all too embarrassed for me to ask that question. Like, how come what happened to the 10th plague? That's true. That's a great question. What's with the 10th plague? The 10th plague, I'm not going to give an answer now at length. Maybe I'll take that as an opportunity to use that as one of the talks over Pesach. The 10th plague is a plague unto itself. The idea of Makas Bechoros, the death of the firstborn, stands alone. Where do we see that it stands alone? Did I lose my mic? I think I did. Okay. What do the Jews need to do to survive the plague of blood? Nothing. And nothing. The Jew. How did a Jew? What did he need to do to not be impacted by blood? Nothing. What did he need to do to not be impacted by frogs, lice? Anybody see a pattern here? I'm going to skip all the way to number 9. What do they need to do to not be impacted by darkness? The Jews had light. What did a Jew need to do to survive the 10th plague? What happens if he didn't? Right? So wait a minute. See, all 9 are against the Egyptians, and if I'm a Jew, I'm saved. All of a sudden you get to number 10, and a Jewish family is in as much in line to be impacted than the Egyptians. Unless he does these other, he brings a sacrifice and he puts the blood on the doorpost and all those other things. That's an example that this is a completely different type of plague, demonstrated something different, which is a talk unto itself, which is independent of the other 9. So it's a good question. There's 3 sets of 3 and the 10th. And that's accurate. What the 10th refers to, why it is that the 10th needed a whole process, that I'm a firstborn. I need to fast until today because I was spared from the 10th plague. I don't do anything because I didn't have to drink blood. Nothing to do with me. But that I'm a firstborn, so till today I need to fast on Erev Pesach. Because I'm a firstborn, and I otherwise would have been killed in the plague had it not been for all of that, the things that go on. So I'm just expressing to you that the 10th is different. How and why, it would be a talk unto itself, but it's an accurate question. Yeah?
Didn't a whole bunch of Jews die in darkness?
Yeah, so a bunch of Jews died in darkness, as we mentioned, but that was not because of the plague of darkness. That was because, since those Jews didn't want to leave, so they were killed in a way that would be the least glorifying to the Egyptians and embarrassing to the Jews while it was dark. So that was a good time to do so, but it wasn't the plague that killed them. It's that they didn't want to leave, so they were, through the purification process of this iron furnace, were eliminated, if you will. But so it was done during darkness because that was a good time, not because it wasn't the plague which killed them. Okay, so where does that leave us? So those are the 3 stages I just wanted to share with you as far as the development of as a people going through. Okay, let's go quickly to page number 6. 1 or 2 more ideas and we'll call it an evening. Getting back to some of our original questions. Source number 2, the Gemara asks the following question. Lomali de Kosov Rachmana Yitzias Mitzrayim Beribis Vitzitzis. B'mishkalos. The Gemara asks the following question. We find that God mentions Mitzrayim in relationship to three mitzvahs which seemingly have nothing to do with Mitzrayim. The Torah says, don't charge interest. You cannot take or collect interest from another Jew. And the Torah says, as kas b'cholos yitain lo b'neshach, don't give him your money with interest. Ani Hashem Elokeichem asher oseis yitzchem yarem Mitzrayim, because I'm the God who took you out of Egypt. Right. Okay. I can't charge interest because God took me out of Egypt. Why does God mention Egypt here? There's 613 mitzvahs. He doesn't say after every single mitzvah, I commanded you on not wearing shatnez, you can't mix wool and linen because I took you out of Egypt. But by interest, when it comes to it, he does say that. And he says it by tzitzis. Place tzitzis on each of the corner of your garments. I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Have honest scales and weights. Why? I am the God who took you out of the land of Egypt. So the Gemara asks, what's the connection? Why is it by these three things that the Torah stresses when it teaches us the prohibition of charging interest, the mitzvah of putting tzitzis on our clothing, the requirement to have honest weights and measures? I took you out of Egypt, says the Gemara. Page, top of page 7. Hashem said, the Holy One said, I am He who discerned in Egypt between the drop of seed which conceived a firstborn and one which did not conceive a firstborn. The sages say, who died in the plague of the firstborn? We're talking about the 10th plague. Plague of the firstborn, only firstborns died. Egypt was a well-known, not such holy place. And it was totally unclear, necessarily, who was everyone's firstborn because of the licentiousness which surrounded the entire society. But only the firstborns died. Only the firstborns. And I will discern who is indeed a firstborn from the mother, who's a firstborn from the father. Those are the only ones who are going to die. I who can discern that, so too am I the one who will bring to justice someone who lends money to a Jew with interest while pretending that it went to a non-Jew. Jews were moneylenders, certainly in the Middle Ages, all the time. So what did it mean to be a moneylender? So it meant that you had a whole slew of money from the landlord, and then you would lend it out to lots of other people. So sometimes you'd be lending it out to Jews, and sometimes you'd be lending it out to non-Jews. If you were lending the money that you had gotten from the big landlord to a non-Jew, then you could charge interest. If you're lending it to a Jew, then you couldn't charge interest. Or if it was your money, you couldn't charge interest. But if it was his money, then you're just an in-between, you could. So it's very easy for a Jew to be able to say, when he's charging interest from another Jew, this really isn't my money that I'm lending you. This is really the landlord's money that I'm out, so I'm charging interest for him. And then simply pocket the money, charging interest. Who's going to know the difference? Says Hashem, I know the difference. I know what's going on with that. And from someone who cheats others by keeping his weight measures in salts, which makes them heavier without changing their appearance. So who's gonna tell you? But you know, you buy a pound of flour, they got the weights. I know. And from someone who puts on a fake blue dye on his tzitzis and claims that it is authentic, which was far cheaper. So says the Gemara, why do these three mitzvahs say, I am the God who took you out of Mitzrayim? Because if you have any doubts that I have the ability and knowledge of exactly each and everything that's happening with each and every individual, I indeed know all of those things as well. And that's as we come out of Mitzrayim, as we come out of the Seder, as we recount these stories of the plagues and of the miraculous events of Mitzrayim, and we're trying to inculcate within ourselves that system, that knowledge, that it is indeed Hashem who is aware of all of these things. I have other sources here for you to look at, but you can look at them on your own. I want to just conclude with two other sources. Flip to the back of your packet, page 15. So with the question with which we had really begun. Sefer Achinuch it was written in the Middle Ages, goes through the 613 mitzvahs, and he suggests reasons for all of the mitzvahs. So he lists each one of the mitzvahs, describes a little bit about them, and then offers his suggestion as to why did Hashem command us in this mitzvah. They're just suggestions, we don't really know for sure, but he gives suggestions. He asks the following question as he talks about the mitzvah of Pesach, and he is the one who asks the question that I started with. It is fitting for us to do symbolic actions, meaning eating matzah, having a Pesach Seder, telling the story, that remind us of the tremendous spiritual heights we reached at the Exodus during the Yetzias Mitzrayim. And through these actions and symbols, the experience of the Exodus is imprinted permanently into our consciousness. We have to do things. And then he asks the question, why did God need to command all these actions in mitzvah? So many. Eating the matzah, getting rid of the chametz, telling the story, just to remember the miracle. Wouldn't it be enough just to think about it once a year to ensure that it is not forgotten from the mouths of our children? Why have to do things? And he answers with a very important yesod, with a very important idea, which really drives almost so much of what we're doing. And he has the language as follows. The Hebrew is the third paragraph. He says it as follows. Ki ha'odam nif'al kefi pu'ulosav. A person is affected and shaped by his actions. This is an idea that he develops at great length, and he talks about it here. This is where he introduces this. We are that which we do. As human beings, it's just our natural makeup. We could think things all we want, but you will become and you will be shaped by your actions more than by your thoughts. So that if you want to become something, if you want to be a better person, so then don't think about being a better person. Be a better person. That's right. And even if you don't necessarily feel like you are as magnanimous, as generous as what it is you're doing, doesn't matter. Just do it. You do it, you do it, you do it. A theology, any philosophy, doesn't maintain itself if it's not rooted in actions. And if you think about the brilliance of what it is that Hashem created for us at our Seder table, we do things. Whether it be the sages telling us to lean to our left, or the matzah that we eat. If we were, imagine just for a second what it would be like if we were to speak about the concept of matzah. We didn't actually eat matzah, but we would speak about the concept of matzah. Just flour and water, and what it means, 18 minutes, and having to be rushed with it, the whole thing. But you didn't ever actually see it or eat it. What kind of impact would that have? Yeah, very little, even though we would talk about it every year. But the fact that we eat it, whether or not you're thinking about all those ideas or not, but the fact that we have to eat it means we will then talk about it, and then we do it. It becomes part of who we are as a people because we're actually doing things. We're not just thinking about them, we do them. And the Sefer HaChinuch has this idea that we're affected and shapes. And your thoughts and your feelings will actually follow your actions. If you want to change the way you think, start by doing things differently. It's a very interesting idea that he has. You want to become a more generous person. So how do you become a more generous person? I want to be a kind of person, when somebody knocks on my door, I want to be more generous with the way that I greet them at the door and give them whatever tzedakah I can afford. But I want to feel better about it. So how should you work on that? Says the Sefer, don't sit in your table and think about it. Be more generous. Be more generous. No, that's not going to do it. You know what you need to do? Open the door with a smile. That's what you need to do. And open it more often. And you give more. And you do more. The more, I want to visit people in the hospital more. I always say I'm going to do it. I never do it. So how do you do it? You got to do it more, and then you'll think about doing it more naturally. Through your actions, you actually impact the way that we think. So, for example, he writes, if a complete degenerate will inspire himself and exert himself to study Torah and perform mitzvos, even for the wrong reasons, such as honor and prestige, he will still begin to change in a positive direction. His self-destructive tendencies will be weakened since he will be influenced by his positive actions. Just do it. I don't care why you're doing it. You're doing it for the honor. You want people to see you coming to shul early and say, oh wow, look at that righteous person. It doesn't matter. The fact that you come changes the way that you think, feel, and are internally. Our external actions impact our internal feelings. And on the other hand, if a completely righteous and upstanding person who exerts himself in Torah mitzvos will occupy himself with negativity and impurity all day long, so then that impacts who he is, and then he will lose his status of righteousness as well. And with this principle in mind, that a person is shaped by his actions, we understand the need for many mitzvahs regarding remembering the Exodus and its miracles, for they are a central feature of the entire Torah. Since our goal of the whole Exodus is to correct that which Avraham had a shortcoming in his level, small infraction, so we hammer it home. And all we talk about all year round, every Friday night we make Kiddush, during Pesach for sure, Zecher L'Tzias Mitzrayim, Zecher L'Tzias Mitzrayim. Why? Because we're trying to accomplish something here. We're trying to do things that instill within us that level of emunah, that instill within us that understanding that indeed it is God who runs the world. We can talk about that all we want. But you know what we need to do to actually make us think that, feel that, and live that? Is actually do that. And therefore we have many, many mitzvahs that all function or focus on that idea of remember Mitzrayim because of the fact that it is so central. I will conclude with one last thought from Rabbi Akiva Tatz. This is from his book, Living Inspired. He wrote an entire book based on this idea, but we'll just talk about it as it relates to Pesach. And it starts on the bottom of page 16. The natural pathway of all life experience begins with inspiration and soon fades to disappointment. He writes, if you haven't read his book, it's a wonderful book, Living Inspired. There's a flash of inspiration, he writes, in which a person sees something that he wants to be in life, a goal he might have, and then the inspiration fades. And then he's just left with this disappointment of, I want that, I saw that flash, and then it dissipates. And then he writes, the goal is for the person then on his own to work, to earn, to achieve that which he saw as a gift, that just flash of inspiration. And in order to save, he brings his examples, the Jewish people in Egypt, outside help was necessary. God appeared and elevated us spiritually, although we did not deserve it intrinsically, had not yet earned it, but through the Exodus, he gave it to us. And then once saved, once inspired, once made conscious of our higher reality, the price must be paid, the experience must be earned, and in working to earn the level which was previously given artificially, one acquires that level genuinely. Instead of being shown a spiritual level, one becomes it. So what he's expressing here is what he expands upon in his book. The Exodus was a gift. The experience of crossing the sea. The experience of, this is what you can be. And then you have 7 weeks on your own to earn it, to get ready for Kabbalah Sator, till Shavuos, from Pesach to Shavuos. The gift of the Exodus, which was the birth process, happened to you, and then you got to get ready and earn it on your own to make it happen. He writes that that's the secret of life. A person is inspired artificially at the beginning of every phase of life. But then to acquire the depth of personality, God removes the inspiration, and then where apathy and depression might seep in, the challenge is to fight back to get to the point of inspiration, but which it becomes part of who you are. You work towards it. And that's the story, he writes, of the Exodus story, as well as many other stories in life, as he describes. Unfortunately, the last sentence on the bottom of the top of the next page, most people do not know the secret, and first comes a phase of unreal positivity, a charge of energy, and then life challenges one to climb back to the real achievement independently. If that's of interest to you, read his book, Living Inspired. He describes that entire idea. Tying it back together, what we have is two major questions on Pesach. There are many, many others. Pesach is a time for questions. Why so many mitzvahs regarding the Pesach Seder? And wasn't it God who put us in this place put us in slavery in the first place? And the reality is that yes, it's both true. Except this is the fundamental tenet of everything that we have of recognizing God as a presence in our life, individually and all-encompassing. And we didn't start that way. Avram Avinu didn't start that way. Avram Avinu had, in his world, slight infractions. And this entire story, yes, God put us in slavery for a purpose, a purification process. And so we hammer that home all the time, living, experiencing Yetzias Mitzrayim, to be able to get us back to that point. And we have to recognize that as we go through that, all the actions that we do, the mitzvahs that we do, all the things that are related to Yetzias Mitzrayim, are all there in order to be able to develop that sense within us, that understanding of which Avraham asked, how will I know? so that we can answer, I know. As our Pesach Seder concludes, who knows one? We know all these things. We know it. We lived it. We experienced it. And we come out of that Seder with a greater sense of knowledge, recognition, living it. Ki ilu hu yatsumi Mitzrayim, as if you yourself went out of Mitzrayim. I wish you all a wonderful Yontiv, an enjoyable time preparing for Yontiv, and then an even more enjoyable time actually experiencing Yontiv. So we'll meet up again the Monday after Pesach, and conclude our last little four or five sections of this course. Have a great Yontiv and a great night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.